a group of Black employees have filed a class action lawsuit against the University of Illinois. They say they face regular racial harassment while on the job. Here's one plaintiff, Derek Brown.
One of the co-workers cut out a rag off a sheet and cut holes in it and put it over his head like the KKK. And all the other white guys in my shop just started laughing.
Also, have you seen the movie Green Book? It talks about sundown towns in the South, but it's something that was actually a bigger issue for Black citizens in Illinois.
And so during this period, 1890 to 1940, town after town in Illinois that had Black populations pushed them out.
Plus, for tens of thousands of Americans, living with sickle cell disease can be excruciating, even deadly. Now, new gene therapy advancements have given a handful of patients hope for a symptom-free life, maybe even a cure. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. And whether you've stayed home for the day or managed to make it into work, we hope you are staying warm. Just outside our Urbana studios, it's negative 37 with the wind chill. In Springfield, the air temperature is negative 11. We're looking at negative 22 in Rockford, negative 13 in Normal. Believe it or not, none of those are record-breaking temperatures. In Chicago, though, they have hit the lowest temperatures in 50 years. And we know that many parts of Illinois has shut down. Of course, stay tuned to this local NPR station to learn more about what's open and closed in your community. If you know about a closing and you don't see it on your local station's website, please don't hesitate to give them a call. We thought about doing today's show on the weather, but we know you know it's cold, and hopefully we know you've got resources available for you. You can always go to ready.illinois.gov for help, and we're here to keep you company for the next hour. There's lots of other news going on. Today, we're beginning with a big story that's coming out of our state's largest public university. A group of Black employees have filed a class action lawsuit against the University of Illinois. The plaintiffs say that they are regularly harassed at work by both colleagues and supervisors, subject to racist and threatening language. Derek Brown is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. He's worked at U of I's facilities and services since 2006. Here's part of what he told WILL in an interview.
One of the co-workers cut out a rag off a sheet and cut holes in it and put it over his head like the KKK. And all the other white guys in my shop just started laughing.
That, again, is just one of many stories in this lawsuit that was filed 2 days ago. Ultimately, the plaintiffs say that the University of Illinois is violating both federal and state law by allowing incidents like this to happen, and that racial harassment is, quote, standard operating procedure on the Urbana campus. Jesse Centrella is an associate with the firm Friedman & Holding. They are the firm that's representing the plaintiffs in this case. And Jesse's on the line with us now from, I believe, New York. Jesse, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Jesse, I wonder if you could start by telling us about the employees you're representing in the lawsuit. There are three named, Derek Brown, Atiba Flemons, and Jeffrey Taylor. Where in the university do they work?
So the three named plaintiffs, Mr. Brown, Mr. Flemons, and Mr. Taylor, Mr. Brown and Mr. Flemons actually work in facilities and services, and Mr. Taylor works in dining. However, the lawsuit is not confined to any specific department. Mr. Brown, Taylor, and Flemons represent a proposed class, which would include all Black employees at the university, excluding employees who would be involved in policymaking with respect to discrimination. What we've seen is widespread racial harassment, not confined to any specific department or to any employee classification.
So the lawsuit said something that stood out to me. The U of I has an office called the Office of Access and Equity. In part, that's a place that's supposed to handle harassment claims. Your clients are alleging that this very office is also a racist workplace.
That's correct. Really what you have with the Office of Access and Equity, which used to be called the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Access, ODEA, is really the fox guarding the hen house. The director of ODEA, as the lawsuit alleges, has used racial stereotypes to refer to Black employees and has engaged in various instances of racial harassment against Black subordinates in the ODA office, in the ODA office itself, and several of her subordinates follow her lead, including the senior associate director of the office, who similarly has engaged in racial harassment, and others, senior leadership in that office, who have acted accordingly.
So your clients are also alleging that the University of Illinois is violating the Civil Rights Act, both the Federal Act of 1964 and the State Civil Rights Act of 2003. How are they doing that?
Well, I mean, the Title VII, which is the federal anti-discrimination law, prohibits racial harassment, and so the university is we're alleging that the university is maintaining policies which in and of themselves are causing racial harassment. Some of those policies are written, and one of which is the university's anti-discrimination policy, which itself allows for a threshold level of racial harassment, and specifically, it allows for racial harassment that it doesn't, as long as it doesn't consider it sufficiently severe, pervasive, objectively offensive, and that which would unreasonably interfere with an employee's ability to do their job. Now, what we've seen is that no conduct will effectively violate that policy. And so what happens is harassers engage in oftentimes explicit forms of racial harassment, and the university concludes that it doesn't violate its policy. Harassers go unpunished and invariably repeat the conduct, and oftentimes intensify the conduct, because the university signals to harassers and to everyone else that it condones this type of treatment. It's very peculiar to have a policy that would permit any racial harassment, and that's what the university's anti-discrimination policy allows.
And so what's the goal with your lawsuit, Jesse?
I mean, change in a single word. But what we'd like to do is have a progressive discipline system put in place so that, harassers don't go unpunished. We'd like for the university to change their anti-discrimination policy so that it doesn't permit racial harassment. And we'd like for, proper oversight of how the university deals with instances of racial harassment, which are occurring widespread over the campus over a significant period of time.
That's Jesse Centrella, an associate with the firm Friedman and Holding. They are representing the plaintiffs in this class action suit against the University of Illinois that was filed on Monday. Jesse, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We have reached out to the University of Illinois for comment on this. So far, they've said they haven't yet fully reviewed this particular lawsuit and cannot yet comment. By the way, that lawsuit filed on Monday is available online. We've tweeted it out at 21ST Show if you would like to read it. The U of I has communicated with WILL reporter Lee Gaines, who is with us now. She covers education for WILL in the Illinois newsroom, and she's with us now in our studios in Urbana. Lee, good morning. Welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
So, Lee, I want to just ask you a little bit about what we were just hearing from Jesse from this firm, what in terms they're looking for with this lawsuit, and just ask you first, just he was talking about the whole idea of this phrase, a standard operating procedure. What stands out to you with this lawsuit? Is it that what he was just talking about, there's a policy, but it seems like the policy itself is allowing for, according to the allegations, more racism and harassment to occur?
That's really the crux of the lawsuit. I think what stands out to me about the lawsuit is two things. One, the severity of what's being alleged. I mean, people are being allegedly being called the N-word. There's use of racial slurs. I talked with Derek, who we heard at the top of the show. He told me that he was at a job site and a white coworker made a makeshift KKK mask, put it over his head and mocked him while the other white coworkers laughed and his supervisor looked on. This is what the lawsuit and what Derek is alleging. So I find that pretty shocking. And then in addition to that, what the lawsuit is basically saying is that not only is Illinois' non-discrimination policy not working to prevent this type of harassment, it's actually allowing this harassment to happen. And the mechanism by which it's doing that is that no matter what someone does, the lawsuit alleges that none of this conduct will rise to the standard of being bad enough to violate the non-discrimination policy.
Is there a clear policy that the university has when it comes to racial harassment in the workplace?
Yes. I mean, you can Google, you know, non-discrimination policy, UIUC, and you can find that pretty easily online. But what this lawsuit is saying is that the Office of Access and Equity, which is the Office of Diversity, Equity and Access, which is what it used to be called, that's the office that you complain to if you feel like that policy has been violated in your case. And basically, it's alleging that the office is not finding that any type of conduct is severe or pervasive, objectively offensive, and maybe most importantly, interfering with one's ability to do their job. I spoke with an attorney on this case, Joshua Friedman, and he told me, like, look, people are going to do their job through pretty much anything because they have people at home to feed. They have a roof to put over their head. So having a bar that high allows for this type of racial harassment to continue unchecked.
I want to come back to Derek Brown, one of the plaintiffs. You were just sharing his story. Lee, you spoke with him yesterday, and I wanted to just play a response to a question he answered. You asked him how bad his work environment at the University of Illinois was.
Oh, it was hell. I wouldn't say bad. I would say hell. Can you imagine being the only black guy and all the rest of the whites think everything he says is funny? And anything, and it's all about you? Every day? It was like, I hate to come to work at some point. Sometimes I use my benefit days just to not go to work. I had to deal with it.
That's Derek Brown, a U of I employee who's one of the few named plaintiffs in this lawsuit filed against the University of Illinois on Monday. It's a class action suit alleging widespread racial harassment across the university. Lee, obviously that's a tough thing to hear. And I think as I was listening to it, it strikes me that I feel like we've had a similar conversation about past. It sounds very similar to how past lawsuits or past complaints have revolved around the university's policies for sexual harassment.
Exactly. And that also struck me about this lawsuit. It's really the same issue at hand. So our listeners probably remember discussions around a law professor named Jay Kaysen, who a reporter here, Christine Herman, did a story about. So Jay Kaysen, there were numerous complaints about
him. I believe more than 30 complaints.
Yeah. 30 right. complaints filed about this law professor to the ODEA, or Office of Access and Equity, saying that he was violating the university's sexual misconduct policy, that he was sexually harassing junior colleagues, junior women colleagues, and also female students at the campus. But that investigation by the ODEA determined that his conduct did not rise to the level of sexual harassment. It was determined that he violated the code of conduct, but his actions weren't bad enough to constitute sexual harassment because they weren't effectively pervasive enough to be that.
And is that the same argument that these...
Exactly. It's the exact same argument, and both of those policies are based off Title VII. And so this lawsuit is saying that the university is violating Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
And what has the university said in response? I mentioned in the beginning, we did invite them to come on the 21st today to talk about this. They did not respond. You've been reaching out to them as well.
In short, not much. They basically said that they take any allegations of misconduct seriously and that discrimination of any sort is not tolerated on the campus.
And so when he said it's a class action suit, does that mean they're seeking other people to join the suit?
So it means that they are correct and also that they are representing people that are similar to the named plaintiffs. So that's all Black employees on this campus, excluding those who work in, who establish policy around racial harassment.
And is this firm also representing another employee with a similar case on the UIC campus in Chicago?
Correct. Yes. They are representing an individual on the Black employee at the University of Illinois Chicago campus. That is not a class action lawsuit, but attorney Josh Friedman told me that they would like to turn it into one.
And so this firm is based in New York. So now there's a suit against UIC and now this suit against the Urbana campus.
Yeah. And I also think it would be it's important for our listeners to know something that we didn't get to in our interview with Jesse is that this, I was told, is a very unique case for them. They have not seen allegations of this severity on university campuses. Joshua Friedman compared what he was hearing from the Black employees here at UIUC to things that he hears, you know, in industrial workplaces and places like shipyards. And they do, he said they do litigation cases that involve higher education institutions, but this is unlike anything they've ever seen before.
That's Lee Gaines, who has been reporting along with WILO's Christine Herman on this. I should note, as our audience, as we always do when we have these conversations, Lee and I technically are employees of the University of Illinois because our home station, WILL, is based on the Urbana campus. Our newsroom, The 21st, maintains editorial independence from the university, but it's just always a good note for all of you listening to understand that. We do our job as journalists. The university is a completely separate institution when it comes to the journalism that we do, but we wanted to make that clear to everybody. Lee, thanks for your reporting. I know you'll keep following the story. We'll keep in touch with you on this.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As you probably are aware, it is dangerously cold today throughout Illinois. The temperature without the wind chill here in Urbana, we have warmed up a full 2 degrees to 10 below zero at this point. There are warming centers open today throughout the state. If you need more information on those locations, head to our Twitter page. Look for our handle, 21STShow. We've been tweeting out resources. And of course, stay tuned to this local NPR station for the latest on closings and weather conditions in your community. In the meantime, we're here all hour to keep you company. Right now, we're going to talk about a disease that an estimated 100,000 people in the U.S. are living with, sickle cell disease. And there's one possible treatment now that's given hope to some patients. The single cell mutation behind this disease can cause excruciating pain, strokes can lead to an early death. And even though scientists have known the cause, there hasn't been a truly effective treatment. As it is, patients can undergo expensive bone marrow transplants or monthly blood transfusions, but few other options exist until now. New experimental gene therapy has given a handful of patients hope for a symptom-free life and even hope for a cure. One of the doctors working on this is Dr. Alexis Thompson, who's the head of hematology for Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. She's joining us now, along with Gina Collada, a senior medical writer for The New York Times. Her reporting inspired this conversation. Dr. Thompson, Gina, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you for having us.
And we also have Latresa Roberts with us. Latresa Roberts' son, Brandon Williams, is one of these patients. Latresa and her 21-year-old son live in Chicago, and she's on the line with us from there now, too. Latresa, thank you for being with us as well. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Latresa, I think lots of people have maybe heard of sickle cell disease, but they don't know what it's like to live with. And I wonder if you can share with us, before he became a part of the study, what was day-to-day like day-to-day life like for your son, Brandon?
Well, he had multiple strokes, and he was having blood transfusions once a month. And, like, he was quiet didn't want to do a lot of things.
Was he in a lot of pain too, Latresa?
No, he had, well, by him having the blood transfusion every month, you know, that stopped a lot of his pains. But he had multiple strokes.
Mm.
You know, the blood wasn't getting to his brain. Mm. So he had a couple of strokes behind that.
And I imagine with all of that, was he able to be in school?
No. Sometimes, you know, he stay out of school maybe 2 to 3 weeks at a time, you know, to going back and forth in the hospital.
Hmm. Dr. Thompson, is what Latresa is describing, is this pretty typical of other sickle cell patients?
It is. This is one of the most devastating complications of sickle cell disease. I think many people are accustomed to thinking about pain, and that is probably the most common manifestation of sickle cell disease. But we've been working really hard to prevent strokes, and we do have made some progress in that in much younger children. But certainly strokes are one serious complication of this condition.
Gina, what causes sickle cell?
So sickle cell is an inherited condition. It's caused by a single mutation in a gene that codes for a subunit of hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is that substance inside of our red blood cells that normally carries oxygen. When individuals inherit this mutation from their parents, that substance inside their cells forms an unusual structure inside the red cells that makes the red cells curve and become very stiff and to create what's called a sickle. Those sickled red cells become very stiff and they get stuck in small blood vessels, and it's that buildup of red blood cells in their small blood vessels that cuts off blood flow to things like your brain, which is the complication that Brandon experienced. In other individuals, it's what causes pain because it cuts off blood flow to things like muscles and bones.
Hmm. That's Dr. Alexis Thompson, who's the head of hematology for Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Latresa Roberts is also with us, sharing the story of her son, Brandon. Latresa, do you know how many strokes Brandon has had then before he entered the study?
Yeah, he had four in all. He had one at 4. He had one at 8, 10, and 16.
Hmm. Gina Colada's also with us from the New York Times, and it's her reporting that inspired this conversation. Gina, I wonder, as Dr. Thompson was sort of explaining what causes sickle cell, it sounds like, in theory, it would seem that treating one gene isn't that complicated, but I imagine it's not as simple as that.
Well, it's not, because even though you may know exactly what's wrong with it, the question is, what are you supposed to do? How are you going to make these hemoglobin cells normal again? So one of the ideas is to use something called gene therapy to stick a new gene in, a good gene, that would produce the right kind of hemoglobin and sort of overcome the problems of the bad genes that are still making the sickled hemoglobin. And then another idea, which is just getting started, is during fetal life, the fetus has its own kind of hemoglobin called fetal hemoglobin, which works perfectly well. There are people who never switch from fetal, which happens after the baby's born, to adult hemoglobin, and they're fine. So the thought was, why don't you turn off the adult hemoglobin switch, which at the same time would turn on the fetal switch, and so instead of making using the mutated gene, people would use a perfectly good fetal gene.
Hmm.
One patient has been through that trial so far, and he seems to be doing really well. He's making fetal hemoglobin.
Wow.
But,
and so,
you know, it's really early days on all these things.
And when we think about sickle cell disease, Gina, this disproportionately affects African-American communities. And I wonder how, based on your reporting, you've seen how that affects funding and opportunities for advancement when we're thinking about treating this.
Well, what I heard was that one of the problems is that the people who had sickle cell disease were disproportionately poor, and they didn't have the kind of foundations. They weren't big donors to foundations that were pushing an agenda. So it was kind of a neglected disease. A lot of people, because they had sickle cell, someone like Brandon had trouble going to school. You have trouble getting jobs, especially if you're out a lot of the time with various pain crises. You have people often have these periodic, they call crises, when they're in agonizing pain. So it's hard sometimes to keep a job, hard to finish your education. So you have people who, because of their disease, are held back in society. So you don't have a lot of big wealthy donors, a lot of public push for funding. And also African Americans, for historical reasons, have often been because of some of the ways that medicine has treated them, have been distrustful of the medical establishment. So they haven't been organized to push for funding. So what's happened is that people feel like it was almost forgotten. It wasn't. If you look at people who are becoming hematologists, they have to do a lot of specialized training in pediatric hematology, that's the study of blood, and they have to choose cancer or sickle cell. Well, all the money, all the support, all the funding is for childhood cancer, blood cancers, not for children with sickle cell. So there's not even as many doctors as you would have expected, considering the prevalence and seriousness of the disease.
Latresa, did you feel that with your family, that it was difficult, especially when we're thinking about Brandon and his treatment in terms of sickle cell, that it was hard to find treatment?
Yes. Yes, at times I did.
And so, go ahead, Latresa.
Well, I mean, we stayed at Children's Memorial, and we had got a lot of help from them.
What was it like when Dr. Thompson came to you and said that Brandon could be part of this trial? What were your initial thoughts?
Well, I was so happy and grateful because my daughter had just passed away with the sickle cell disease, and so my son didn't want to live anymore because all he's thinking about is, when is I'm going to die, because I got the sickle cell too. And so he was saying, I just don't want to live no more. So he went to the hospital to get his blood transfusion, and he was talking to them. So she said, well, you know, I got something, maybe we can try. So I'm like, okay, you know, it can't hurt us. So, you know, this is something we got to try for him to live, to want to live. And I said, yes, we're going to do this.
And so, Dr. Thompson, what was the treatment like for Brandon as he entered this trial? What did he have to do?
So I can tell you about how the trial is set up. Up until that time, Brandon was getting standard of care, which is chronic transfusions, but it really isn't enough, and it certainly would never cure the fundamental problem with sickle cell disease. And so what this trial consists of is obtaining stem cells, which are the cells that in your body that normally would make red blood cells, obtaining those from his body, sending them to a laboratory, then in the laboratory, using a viral vector to insert a copy of a normal healthy hemoglobin gene into his cells, and then freezing those cells. Brandon came into the hospital, was given a few doses, limited doses of chemotherapy to prepare his body to receive his cells back. He was then given his cells back in an IV infusion. And then he was in the hospital for a few weeks after that, while we were waiting for those cells to return to the bone marrow, which is where blood cells are made, and to begin growing. And then once we saw that he was recovering nicely, he was sent home. And Brandon has continued to do well. He has not required any transfusions. He has not had any symptoms of sickle cell disease, and he enjoys a normal hemoglobin. So we are absolutely thrilled with his early results.
From that one treatment, Dr. Thompson?
From that single treatment. It's quite remarkable in that way, and we're just beyond his 1 year mark, and I think that we're very optimistic that if others have similar outcomes, that this really may be a breakthrough for sickle cell disease.
Latresa, what was it like to get that call from Dr. Thompson that Brandon was producing normal blood cells?
I was so happy, and all I could do was start crying and saying, thank you, Lord, because he did not have to live no more thinking that I'm going to die from sickle cell. So it was a blessing. It was just overwhelming that I just jumped up and just started crying. Thank you, Lord. Thank you. He cured my son. It's a miracle.
Wow, it certainly sounds that way. Gina Colada is also with us from the New York Times. Gina, you're a senior medical writer for the Times, and you've covered different medical advances for your entire career. And I wonder, from your perspective, as someone who writes about this all the time, what are the other implications for this research as we're looking at the fact that this is a gene editing technology that's being used?
Well, it's sort of it's an example of the beginning of what may be a whole new era in medicine. There's going to be problems, though, and that is that these are probably going to be very expensive therapies, and especially with sickle cell, where there are enormous numbers of people in sub-Saharan Africa who have this disease. If you have one copy of a mutated gene, everybody has two copies of each gene, you are protected from malaria. So that's why the theory is that that's why this gene persisted. But if you happen to inherit two copies, you get sick with sickle cell. Well, bringing an expensive and difficult therapy like that to sub-Saharan Africa seems almost infeasible. So one of the ironies here is that people who may really need it, most of the people who may really need it, can only look on and say, if only I lived in a place like America and had some money. And then there's going to be the question of how much your insurance company is going to pay. Because as more and more of these sophisticated therapies become available at a very high price, there are going to be questions of how is it going to be paid for and who's going to pay for it.
When it comes to the medical advances, Gina, how big of a deal do you think this is?
It's really huge. I mean, people have been dreaming of doing something like this with sickle cell for decades and decades and decades. And it really shows the way. It really paves the way for showing that this kind of thing really can happen so far. I mean, it looks really good so far. It's sort of, one guy said, it's uncharted territory. Everybody hopes it's going to last. If someone like Brandon he's done for the rest of his life, he'll make normal hemoglobin. But, you know, it hasn't been that long. Something could happen that's unexpected. So I think it's a huge advance. It's some good news for a change. And it's and people like Mrs. Roberts, I mean, to have your son have four strokes, have him suffer his entire life, and now all of a sudden at age 21 you can say, you can start again. Now you're making enough hemoglobin. You don't have to worry anymore about this. That's enormous. Just what that would do for families is incredible.
Latresa, I wanted to ask you how Brandon's doing. As we said, this has been a year. What's his life like right now?
Oh, he's doing wonderful. He's looking to looking for a job, and he's ready and eager to go. His life can begin, you know, he's ready. He was like, I just want a job. I just want to go out here and live my life now and take care of myself. I said, yeah.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. That's Latresa Roberts. I appreciate you sharing you and your family story with us. I want to thank Dr. Alexis Thompson for being with us as well, head of hematology at Lurie's Children's Hospital in Chicago, part of Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. And as we're saying, part of this story that originally came to us from Gina Colada at the New York Times. We'll tweet out Gina's story if you'd like to read more about this research and what is being done. But Dr. Thompson, Gina, Latresa, thank you all for being with me. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Nyla.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We hope you're staying warm today. Remember, you can visit ready.illinois.gov if you need help or advice. And in the meantime, we're keeping you company. After the Civil War and Reconstruction, white Southerners took action to restrict the rights of Black men, women, and families. Today, most of us know them as Jim Crow laws. And these laws were in many ways a backlash to the abolition of slavery. And according to historian and scholar James W. Lowen, another kind of backlash was happening in the North. Sundown towns, places where Black citizens were not only barred from living there, but where it wouldn't be safe if they stayed in town after dark. This is one part of the movie Green Book, which came out last fall, but Jim has been writing about this for years. His 2005 book, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, is one of the few scholarly works on this topic. He's originally from Decatur and is now a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here and welcome back to Illinois Airwaves.
Yes, I want to say hi to all my stomping grounds out there.
So, Jim, I mentioned that you are from Decatur. That's where you grew up. Did you know about sundown towns in Illinois when you were growing up here?
I did not. I did know that the little towns around Decatur didn't have any Black folks. Little towns like Monticello, Mount Zion, Blue Mound, and Iliopolis. All the little towns around Peoria, such as Metamora and Peoria Heights and so on, all the little towns around Springfield. Well, I didn't know that they were all sundown because I only lived in Decatur, but I knew they were all white. And then I actually had an aha moment doing this research, and it happened in Decatur. I was the keynote speaker for the second biennial Decatur Writers Conference. So there I am speaking in the Decatur Public Library to a nicely sized audience about my bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me. And I ended by telling them what I was now working on. This was in the year 2000. I was working on sundown towns. And I told them what a sundown town was, and I asked that if anybody knew anything about it, would they please come down afterward to talk with me? And to my astonishment, more than 20 people came down, and they told me stories about every little town around Decatur that I just mentioned.
Were they Black or white? Both?
Champaign. These are all white folks. And they told me that, for example, they told me that Villa Grove, which is near Champaign-Urbana, had a siren or whistle that sounded at 6 p.m. to tell Black folks to be gone. Well, I thought that was apocryphal. I mean, but it did tell me that two people told me that, and it did tell me that they both understood Villa Grove to be a sundown town and that it had a whistle. I thought it was probably a shift change at a factory. But sure enough, a year later, when I went to Villa Grove to check it out, I learned absolutely that the siren is on the water tower, that it indeed sounded for that purpose. Not everybody understood that, but many, many people did. So it was absolutely not safe for a Black person to be in Villa Grove after that siren went off, and they had only stopped the siren in 1999. So I learned, in other words, that every one of these towns around all of these cities in central Illinois that was all white was not all white by accident. It was all white on purpose.
And when did this start? When did the history of when this became?
This
when did this
mostly started? Pretty late. It wasn't obvious. It didn't come about before the Civil War or anything like that. Mostly it happened between 1890 and 1940. And historians have a name for this period. And this period is called the nadir of race relations. Well, several bad things happened in 1890 that caused us to date it precisely from then. One of them is the Mississippi Constitution got changed to openly forbid Blacks from being citizens, from voting, from being on juries, and so on. And this is blatantly unconstitutional, but the United States did nothing about it. And so every other southern state and states as far away as Oklahoma followed suit by 1908. Things like that happened in 1890. And so during this period, 1890 to 1940, town after town in Illinois that had Black populations pushed them out, sometimes violently, sometimes just cold-shouldering them out. Sometimes one person was lynched and the rest of the Black community thought they better leave. And then if you didn't have a Black population, like, for instance, as far as I know, Monticello didn't, but Monticello passed an ordinance. You can't find it, but the city attorney swears that they did pass one. Other people I've talked with who were on the city council and so on believe that they passed it. So that's when it happened, between 1890 and 1940. And there's lots of towns that had a Black population up until until maybe 1908 or 1910 or whenever, and then they didn't have one for decades.
Jim, did this happen in Illinois mostly in smaller towns? I imagine, was this in a larger place, like I'm thinking particularly the size of a place like Springfield in the 1900s was pretty large?
Springfield in 1908 had the Springfield race riot, which was an attempt to make Springfield into a sundown town. And indeed, the white mob attacked the black community. They lynched two people, and they drove out two-thirds of the black population, and they yelled at them, "Abe Lincoln brought you in, we will drive you out." Now, they failed because it was just too big a project, and also because the governor had the notice. I mean, after all, he lives in Springfield. So on the second day, they finally called out the National Guard, and about half of the two-thirds that got driven out came back to Springfield. But in the aftermath of that riot, little satellite expulsions took place in little towns around Springfield. The biggest town that did go sundown was Pekin. Numbers of Chicago suburbs went sundown. Cicero was the most infamous. Cicero had little race riots in every year ending in one after World War II in 1951, 61, 71, and 81. So it was clearly a sundown town. And in fact, about 75% of the Chicago suburbs were sundown towns, and a couple of them still are.
So, Jim, regardless of whether or not, when we think about slavery as sort of a defining, we tend to think of, I think, whether or not slavery was allowed as a way to define race relations in a state. But I wonder what the existence of laws like creating sundown towns, if that, how that also affected race relations. That's kind of something we don't know that much about and don't talk about as much.
We don't. You're right. And not only that, we don't know about the nadir of race relations, this terrible period, 1890 to 1940. And that's the period when the North really solidified its racism. Of course, the South did too. That is, it's the Jim Crow era. But when we think about Jim Crow, most people think about it in the South, that you got these, you know, white and colored bathrooms and stuff like that. And indeed, we never had that in Illinois, well, hardly ever. We didn't have that in the North, but we had all these sundown towns. That's particularly ironic. You mentioned in your introduction this new movie, The Green Book. Well,
Not without controversy, I feel like I should also point out.
Yeah, well, I saw The Green Book. It's a good movie, but sociologically, it's terrible. And here's the problem. It now is the fifth Hollywood movie that treats sundown towns, at least that I know of. And of those five that treat sundown towns, four put them in Mississippi and one puts them in Georgia. Now, I lived in Mississippi for years, so I tried to find every sundown town I could. I found three. Compare Illinois, my other home state. I'm now at a count of 506. There's just no comparison. Now, in the Green Book, these folks go across Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, and they never come to a sundown town. And then they encounter one in Mississippi. We have a tendency in America to put severe racism in the Deep South, and that gets the rest of us off the hook. But sundown towns are a Midwestern phenomenon. They're a phenomenon in Oregon. They're a phenomenon in Pennsylvania. And they're almost unheard of in the Deep South. The only place they exist in the Deep South is in the non-Deep South, like, for instance, the outside of Florida.
I wonder how you think African Americans throughout this period when this was being adopted in the 19th and 20th century, how did they respond and adapt to these sundown town laws?
Well, many of them responded by not going out much. That is to say, by not taking vacations, by not traveling much. One reason for that was because they could get in trouble. One of the major crossroads in America, in fact, I think they call themselves the Crossroads of Mid-America or something like that, is Effingham, Illinois. And Effingham had both two major railroad lines, the North-South line that still has the city of New Orleans, and also the main line of the New York Central that goes from New York to St. Louis, and St. Louis was a huge rail center. Well, those both were in Effingham, and also two major bus routes, namely North-South, which is now the interstate going from Chicago to Effingham South, and what was called the National Road going from Washington again to St. Louis. Well, if you actually, let's say, had a trip that took you to Effingham, and then you changed from bus to train or whatever, you had about a two-block walk, and that could be life-threatening. People were advised to take a taxi, black people, especially if it was after dark, but even if it was before dark. So people knew about this stuff in the black community with or without the Green Book. The Green Book doesn't know too much about sundown towns because Mr. Green was in Harlem and he wasn't as familiar with the idea that as well, most black people didn't realize they were as widespread as I found them to be. So people in Illinois, in particular black people, just didn't travel as much. They were scared to travel. And when they did, they would go to big cities. If they're going to have a good time, they would go to Chicago. They would not go to, say, Branson, Missouri, where all kinds of white tourists go, because they knew that that wasn't for them. And indeed, Branson was probably a sundown town.
Jim, I wonder, as we're thinking about not just this Green Book and everyone watching this movie, and as you're saying, the historical inaccuracies or it sort of playing to misconceptions that racism was just in the South, I wonder, even apart from that, why you think we should be talking about this? Because I bet you talk to some people who say,
sure,
yeah, this was in our past. Why don't we just move forward as a country
now
instead of dwelling on this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is what we call second-generation sundown town problems. And Ferguson, Missouri, supplies a wonderful example. Everybody's heard of Ferguson, of course, because of, shall we say, the race riot or the racial disturbances that happened, 4 years ago. And Ferguson was one of the very few suburbs of St. Louis that actually had a small black population. But they put more and more pressure against it, and that black population dwindled from 60 in 1940 down to just 15 by 1960, which is when Ferguson attained sundown town status. And that dwindling happened while the overall population of Ferguson went from 5,000 to 20,000. So there's no reason for it other than overt pressure, including what we call DWB, or driving while black, policing. Well, Ferguson got over it. After 1960, they could no longer stem the tide, shall we say. And, of course, once several black families move into a former sundown suburb, it tends to go majority black quite quickly because the white population has already been exposed to the ideology that black folks are criminal and are terrible and we got to keep them out. And so as soon as, you know, that becomes impossible, then they say, holy moly, we got these terrible criminal people coming in. I'm going to sell. And that's what happened in Ferguson. Ferguson went about 67% black, but the police force stayed 99% white and continued to do DWB policing. And that's one example of a second-generation sundown town issue. Other examples of flick towns in Illinois. Pekin, for instance, has had problems of people harassing black athletes when they come visiting Pekin in cross-country or basketball or football. Just all kinds of bad things happening, even though Pekin now has a handful of black families and therefore is not literally a sundown town. So I think that every sundown town in Illinois needs to do something about it, even if it's beyond being a sundown town. I suggest a three-step program. One, admit it. We did this. And it's interesting. Some sundown towns won't even do that, even though we have the goods on them. Number two, we did it, and it was wrong, and we're sorry. In other words, apologize. And third, and we don't do it anymore. And that third step needs to have teeth. We are now hiring black cops. We're now hiring black garbage men and garbage women. We are now hiring black teachers, and we're making it possible for them to live in the city.
Jim, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Jim Lowen is a historian. He's the author of Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. Thank you for being with
me. Might I add a plea? And my plea is to any listener who knows something about a town and its sundown tradition. I'm always trying to learn more, and at my website, I'm trying to compile a complete registry of all the sundown towns that there ever were. And so you might email me at jlowen, J-L-O-E-W-E-N, at uvm.edu, and tell me about the sundown town that you know about, and I'll get in an email conversation with you.
Jim, thanks for sharing that and for making the time to speak with us.
Have a wonderful day.
That's all the time we have for today. Stay warm. Try not to go outside. It will stay in the negatives all day. And again, please stay tuned to this local NPR station if you need to know more about closings in your town. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. All of them here today in the building working for you guys. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. And I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.